Good afternoon, and welcome to the meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1985, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Before I introduce today's speaker, I want to make sure that all of you know that the Midcoast Forum will be sponsoring a debate on foreign policy among the three candidates vying to replace Senator Olympia Snow: Democrat Cynthia Dill, Republican Charlie Summers, and Independent Angus King. And that's scheduled for Thursday, October 11th at the Camden Opera House from 6 to 7:30. Now today, the forum is delighted to introduce Professor Stephen Walt, the Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School. He's been a resident associate of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution, served as a consultant for the Institute of Defense Analysis, the Center for Naval Analysis, and the National Defense University. He presently serves on the editorial boards of Foreign Policy. He writes a blog quite frequently on the Foreign Policy website. He's also on the editorial boards of Security Studies, International Relations, and the Journal of Cold War Studies, and is a fellow at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Professor Walt is the author of a number of books in international affairs, including Taming American Power: The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and his most well-known book, co-authored with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. The title of his talk today, Deja Vu All Over Again, Iraq, Iran, and the Israel Lobby. So let's give a warm welcome to Steve Walt.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here today, and I want to thank Mac DeFord and the board members of the Midcoast Forum for the invitation and the very nice welcome they gave my wife and I yesterday. My wife and I fell in love with this part of the Maine coast a few years ago. So before I get started with the substance of my remarks, I just want to say if anyone wants to get rid of some waterfront property cheap, please let me know. And thank you all for coming. Over the past few months, we've seen an intense debate over the possibility of war with Iran. The United States and Iran have been at odds for many years. The United States has long been concerned about Iran's nuclear research program. There have been several moments in the past where the danger of war seemed real. Remember, the Bush administration once hoped that winning a quick and decisive victory in Iraq would allow it to turn on Iran and force regime change there as well. Now, Iraq didn't work out the way Bush and company expected, but that debacle hasn't stopped a number of people from suggesting that Israel or the United States should launch a preventive war to retard Iran's nuclear program. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has repeatedly described a nuclear-armed Iran as an existential threat and warned of a second Holocaust. Some of Israel's most vocal defenders in the United States have echoed these views. Journalists like Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic have published articles suggesting that Israel was likely to attack if Iran did not halt its nuclear activities. Most of the GOP presidential hopefuls described Iran as a looming danger during the primary season. They rejected any policy designed to contain it, said they would use force if they were elected. And the issue, as you all know, came up again during Mitt Romney's rather controversial visit to Israel last week. The New York Times reporting just last Thursday that Israeli and U.S. officials were engaged in intense discussions about possible military options. Now, needless to say, this all sounds eerily familiar. In the 1990s, neoconservatives in the United States portrayed Saddam Hussein's Iraq as a major threat to U.S. interests and began a prolonged campaign to persuade Americans to use force to overthrow him. Their efforts did not bear fruit immediately. But President Bush and Vice President Cheney embraced their ideas after 9/11 and led the country into a war that cost more than $1 trillion, more than 4,500 American and 100,000 Iraqi lives, and weakened America's strategic position in the oil-rich Persian Gulf. Yet just a few years later, Americans are once again debating whether to launch a preventive war in the same region for much the same reasons. So today what I want to do is compare the earlier campaign for war with Iraq with the current debate over military action against Iran, and I'm going to make three main points. First, I'm going to argue there are some important similarities between these two situations. Specifically, in both cases, the main driving force behind the campaign for war are hardline individuals and groups in the so-called Israel lobby. By Israel lobby, I mean groups or individuals in the United States who actively work to promote a special relationship between the United States and Israel, one where the United States gives Israel generous economic, military, and diplomatic support and gives it more or less unconditionally. These groups are not the only reason the United States went to war in Iraq. They didn't cause the war by themselves. But without their efforts, the United States would not have invaded Iraq in 2003, and we wouldn't be debating a war with Iran today. I'm then going to talk about the differences between 2003 and 2012. In particular, the pro-Israel community in the United States is not united on the issue of Iran. Israel's own national security community is divided about the question of preventive war, and the Obama administration is much less inclined to use force than the Bush administration was, all of which makes war less likely. Third point, these differences are a very good thing because a military attack on Iran would be a major strategic blunder, obviously harmful to Iran, but also bad for Israel and for the United States. And that point underscores a broader lesson. The most influential groups in the Israel lobby consistently promote policies that are harmful to nearly everyone, including Israel itself. Now, finally, I'll just note at the end that this whole approach to Iran, I think, also distracts us from a number of other problems in the region, most notably the continued dispossession of the Palestinians and denial of their political rights. That's not my main focus today, but it's an issue we should not lose sight of. So let me start by talking a little bit about the war with Iraq and how we got there. When John Mearsheimer and I first published our work on the Israel lobby in 2006, I think no claim was more controversial than our argument that the lobby had played a key role in the decision to invade Iraq. It was clear by 2006 that the war had been a huge blunder. It was hardly surprising that the people who had helped bring it about sought to deny any responsibility afterwards. Our critics couldn't refute our actual arguments directly, so they mostly chose to misrepresent us, or to portray us falsely as anti-Semites and conspiracy theorists. So let me talk a little bit about what we actually said and then offer some evidence for it. In our original London Review of Books article in March 2006, we said, quote, "The driving force behind the Iraq war was a small band of neoconservatives," end quote. It was the neocons who dreamed up the idea of using American power to topple Saddam, and it was the neocons who openly advocated this course from the mid-1990s onward. Their efforts included a series of open letters addressed to President Clinton, numerous articles and op-eds in places like the Weekly Standard, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. The key point is this idea did not originate with the U.S. military, the State Department, the intelligence agencies, or the oil industry. As Tom Friedman of the New York Times told an interviewer in 2005, Iraq was the war the neoconservatives wanted, the war the neoconservatives marketed. I could give you the names of 25 people here in Washington who, if you'd exiled them to a desert island in 2001, the Iraq War would not have happened. As you know, that's Tom Friedman, not me. As you know, the neoconservatives are an especially hawkish faction within the broader Israel lobby. Virtually all the prominent neocons, people like William Kristol, James Woolsey, Robert Kagan, Paul Wolfowitz, Elliot Abrams, etc., are all ardent defenders of the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. Many of these individuals held important positions in the Bush administration where they played key roles pushing for war with Iraq. For example, at the very first meeting at Camp David after 9/11, Paul Wolfowitz argued for invading Iraq before Afghanistan, even though we knew bin Laden was in Afghanistan and there was no evidence linking Iraq to al-Qaeda. Neoconservatives outside the government expressed similar views, with Robert Kagan and William Kristol calling for regime change in Iraq immediately after 9/11, even before the Taliban had been toppled in Afghanistan. A few months later, in April 2002, the neoconservative Project for a New American Century released yet another open letter, this time urging President Bush, quote, to accelerate plans for removing Saddam Hussein. So the role of the neoconservatives is really beyond dispute here. What about groups like AIPAC or the other major organizations in the Israel lobby? They did not come up with the idea of invading Iraq, and they do not appear to have done very much to convince President Bush to decide on war. Instead, these groups played an important role convincing Congress and the American people to back Bush's plan. For example, in the months preceding the war, AIPAC's biweekly bulletin, the Near East Report, published numerous articles highlighting the danger from Iraq, including a lengthy interview with Ken Pollack of the Sabin Center at Brookings. Pollack was the author of a book, The Threatening Storm, which argued that regime change was necessary because Saddam Hussein was not deterrable if he ever got weapons of mass destruction. Pollack's boss at the Sabin Center was Martin Indyk, the former deputy director of research at AIPAC, co-founder of the Washington Institute on Near East Policy, and both Pollack and Indyk wrote articles and op-eds calling for war in late 2002 and 2003. But there's more. In 2003, AIPAC executive director Howard Kaur told the New York Sun that one of AIPAC's success stories in 2002 was, quote, quietly lobbying Congress to approve the resolution authorizing the use of force. And he wasn't just bragging. John Judis of the New Republic later recounted that Senate staffers had told him personally about AIPAC's pre-war lobbying activities. AIPAC spokesperson Rebecca Needler told the Jewish Telegraph Agency, if the president asks Congress to support action in Iraq, AIPAC would lobby members of Congress to support him, and of course they did. In addition to AIPAC, the Jewish Council on Public Affairs, and the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations passed resolutions endorsing the use of force, with the chairman of the President's Conference, Mortimer Zuckerman, being especially outspoken about the need to topple Saddam. Not to be outdone, David Harris of the American Jewish Community pointedly asked, do we have to wait until a target is hit and the world says, ah, yes, he did have weapons of mass destruction after all? As the Jewish newspaper Forward recalled in a 2004 editorial, as President Bush attempted to sell the war in Iraq, America's most important Jewish organizations rallied as one to his defense. Community leaders stressed the need to rid the world of Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. Finally, prominent Christian Zionists also backed the war, with the Reverend John Hagee of Christians United for Israel telling his followers, if Saddam Hussein is allowed to dictate the terms of this war, the front lines of war will explode in American cities with a death toll too staggering to comprehend. Saddam must go. In short, the role of the neoconservatives and the other key organizations in the Israel lobby really can't be denied. Before I turn to Iran, I want to highlight six important caveats about what I just said about the war in Iraq. First, as I said at the outset, the neocons and other groups in the lobby are not all powerful, and they didn't start the war by themselves. They failed to convince Bill Clinton to go to war, and they were unable to persuade Bush and Cheney to go to war until after 9/11. If 9/11 had never happened, the United States, in my view, would not have invaded Iraq. So the lobby's activities were a necessary condition for war, but not a sufficient condition. Second, the war was not the result of some secret cabal or conspiracy to take over the U.S. government. On the contrary, the neoconservatives made their case for war openly and, in fact, went to enormous lengths to publicize their views, as did the leaders of the major pro-Israel organizations. And, of course, they were happy to take credit for it afterwards until the war started to go south. Third, Advocates of war did not push this policy because they thought it would be good for Israel but bad for the United States. They thought it would be good for both countries. So they weren't disloyal, just tragically wrong. Fourth, the idea of invading Iraq did not originate with Israel. Indeed, Israeli officials were skeptical at first because they wanted the United States to focus on Iran. Israel backed the war after the Bush administration explained that Iraq was just the first step and Iran and Syria would be dealt with afterwards. And at that point, key Israeli leaders, including Shimon Peres, Ehud Barak, and Benjamin Netanyahu, all helped sell the war through interviews with the media, op-eds in prominent American newspapers, and appearances up on Capitol Hill. Fifth, it's worth asking what would have happened had these organizations adopted a different approach. Suppose AIPAC or the President's Conference had encouraged a lively debate on this topic and helped Congress sift the pros and cons of war in a fair-minded way. What if the Israeli government had recognized the dangers of war and encouraged AIPAC or the President's Conference to oppose it? It's possible that Bush, Cheney, and the neocons would still have managed to take us over the brink anyway, but it would have been much more difficult. Opposition or neutrality from these organizations would have encouraged Congress to think twice about the issues, would have given them good reasons to slow the rush for war. We might have had a real debate about the military requirements of an occupation, the risks of a costly quagmire. Of course, the problem wasn't that the key organizations in the lobby failed to speak out against the war. The problem was that many of them actively worked to sell the war to the American people. Finally, last point, it would be an enormous error to blame the American Jewish population for the war. In fact, surveys of U.S. public opinion before the war showed that the American Jewish population was less supportive of the decision to invade than the American people as a whole. Rather, the blame for the war lies first with President Bush and his advisors, who made the ultimate decision, with the neoconservatives, who dreamed up the idea and sold it to Bush and Cheney, and with the major groups in the lobby, who did much to sell it inside and outside the Beltway, which reminds us that interest groups do not always represent the real views of the populations in whose name they often claim to speak. Let me now turn to the issue of Iran, which is in some ways similar and in some ways very different. First of all, if Israel didn't exist and there was no Israel lobby, the United States would probably still have a contentious relationship with Iran. Iranians resent our role in the 1953 coup that restored the Shah. The Americans, of course, we all remember the hostage crisis that followed the fall of the Shah. We worry about Iran's potential to dominate the Gulf. The United States would probably oppose any Iranian attempt to obtain nuclear weapons because we generally oppose nuclear proliferation. We care about security in that part of the world. So the Israel lobby is not the only reason why the United States and Iran have a difficult relationship. Nonetheless, both Israel and the lobby have long encouraged the United States to take a hard-line stance towards Iran and sought to block any efforts at reconciliation between the two countries. In the 1990s, for example, the United States adopted a strategy known as dual containment, which committed the United States to deter Iran and Iraq simultaneously. This strategy was the brainchild of Martin Indyk, again, who was at that point handling Middle East affairs on the National Security Council. According to both Indyk's colleague Ken Pollack and also author Trita Parsi, dual containment was a policy adopted largely to reassure Israel. Then in 1994, AIPAC responded to growing Israeli concerns about Iran by preparing a lengthy paper, about 80-page paper, portraying Iran as a growing threat to Israel and the United States alike. And throughout the rest of the 1990s, AIPAC pushed very hard for increasingly stringent sanctions on Iran. They also successfully lobbied President Clinton to block an oil deal between Iran and the oil company Conoco in 1996. When we get to the Bush administration, of course, the neoconservatives there were just as hostile to Iran as they were to Iraq. They believed regime change should include Tehran as well as Baghdad. In fact, in May 2003, when it looked like the United States had won a stunning victory in Iraq, William Kristol wrote in the Weekly Standard that the job wasn't finished and, quote, the next great battle will be for Tehran. Other neoconservatives echoed this hope as well. The neocons' fantasies of regional transformation evaporated when Iraq turned into a costly quagmire. Nonetheless, the Bush administration continued to insist that Iran had to suspend all nuclear enrichment before any negotiations could take place. In essence, Bush was demanding that Iran give us what we wanted most up front, at which point we would be willing to talk about anything that might be on Iran's agenda. This approach was a complete failure. Iran had exactly zero centrifuges spinning when Bush took office. It had roughly 4,000 operating when Bush's second term ended. Nonetheless, a national intelligence estimate in 2007 concluded that Iran had in fact suspended research on nuclear weapons, not nuclear energy, in 2003 and had no active weapons program underway as of 2007. This finding was also consistent with Iran's repeated insistence that it did not seek nuclear weapons and with Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei's declaration that nuclear weapons were in fact contrary to Islam. So when Israeli leaders sought a green light from the Bush administration to launch a preventive strike against Iran's nuclear facilities in 2008, Bush's response was a firm no. The last thing the United States needed at that point was war with another Muslim country. Even so, AIPAC managed to kill a provision to a defense bill that would have required President Bush to get congressional authorization to use force against Iran, because doing so would, in AIPAC's view, take the use of force off the table. So as the Bush administration came to a close, a number of other individuals and groups in the lobby continued to push for a hardline American approach. September 2008, for example, two well-known neoconservatives, Michael Makovsky and Michael Rubin, published a task force report for the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington, which again portrayed Iran as a looming threat to American interests and recommended that we demand they abandon all nuclear activities backed up by the use of force if necessary. Which brings us to Obama. Obama began with some symbolic gestures to engage Tehran and agreed to direct talks on Iran's nuclear program. The two countries actually almost reached a deal on a fuel swap in 2009 that would have reduced Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium in exchange for providing fuel for a research reactor in Tehran. Those efforts, however, were derailed in part by the contested Iranian presidential election in 2009, which made compromise more difficult for both sides, and by miscommunication and vacillation, again on both sides, over the fuel swap deal. Yet even as Obama was supposedly extending an open hand to Iran, the United States was also tightening sanctions and ramping up covert action against Iran, culminating, we now know, in the Stuxnet computer virus attack in 2010. And there's good evidence, by the way, that key officials in the administration expected diplomacy to fail and, in a sense, were just going through the motions to justify the use of force later. We continued to demand that Iran halt all enrichment, and top officials repeatedly declared an Iranian bomb unacceptable and repeated that all options were on the table. Pushed by Congress, Washington also orchestrated a successful international campaign to tighten sanctions on Iran, including the blacklisting of Iran's central bank. And it's in this period, by the way, that a number of Iranian nuclear scientists are assassinated, although Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has explicitly denied that the United States was involved with that. But if you take all of that together, it highlights the basic contradiction in our approach to the problem. We are, on the one hand, supposedly trying to convince Tehran that we have no hostile intentions, and therefore they have no need for a nuclear deterrent. But by ratcheting up pressure, by continuing to talk about military action, by mentioning that we still favor regime change, we are giving the government there a clear incentive to acquire the ultimate deterrent, or at least get very close to that capability. Not surprisingly, Iran has responded not by capitulating to American demands, but by building additional enrichment facilities, including an underground site at Fordo that is vulnerable only to high-tech bunker-busting bombs that the United States alone possesses. Fears that war might be imminent began to increase again in the fall of 2010. The Netanyahu government continued to hype the threat. Jeffrey Goldberg wrote a cover story in the September 2010 issue of The Atlantic, which concluded that Israel was likely to strike by the spring of 2011. Now, this forecast proved to be as accurate as Goldberg's earlier writings about Iraq, that is to say, it was dead wrong. But the New York Times Magazine actually published an updated version of essentially the same argument by an Israeli journalist, Ronan Bergman, last January. Like the earlier Goldberg article, Bergman suggested time was running out, that Israel's leaders were getting very close to launching a preventive strike. The possibility of war with Iran soon began to permeate the Republican primary contest, with Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, and Rick Santorum all trying to outdo each other in their expressed willingness to use force on Israel's behalf. The war fever peaked at AIPAC's annual policy conference last spring. Netanyahu spoke to the conference, telling his audience, quote, "Iran must never be allowed to get nuclear weapons," declaring containment is not an option, that diplomacy had failed, and that none of us can afford to wait much longer. Senator Joseph Lieberman told the audience, "The question is not whether we can stop them, but whether we will choose to stop them. All options must be on the table except for one option, and that is containment." Now, let's be clear. Lieberman was saying that war will be necessary if Iran does not give in to our demands. President Obama sought to deflect pressure for action in his own remarks, both denouncing what he called loose talk about war and reiterating that, quote, he had Israel's back. Yet he also gave an interview to Jeffrey Goldberg where he says, "I do not have a policy of containment. I have a policy to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon." And Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta said much the same thing in Israel last week. Loose talk about war, I think, has receded a bit since then. There have been some new negotiations earlier this summer, some hints that a deal might be in the offing which would permit Iran to continue low-level enrichment if it reduced its stockpile of more highly enriched uranium. That's a step, by the way, that would lengthen the amount of time it would take Iran to break out and build a bomb if they ever chose to. But the United States has continued to issue demands that are, in my view, probably deal breakers, and I frankly doubt there will be any sort of an agreement between now and November. Let me now talk about each of those developments and compare essentially what's been happening over the last year or so with what happened in the run-up to war with Iraq in 2003. As I said, there are some important similarities, but the good news is there's also some key differences. The most obvious similarity is that the main advocates of a hardline approach, including the use of force, have been the same people and the same groups that pushed for an attack on Iraq in 2003. So William Kristol, who led the Project for a New American Century, helped lead the earlier campaign for war with Iraq, has since launched two new organizations, one the Emergency Committee for Israel, a second one called the Foreign Policy Initiative. Both groups have hyped the threat from Iran. They favor military action to keep it from crossing the nuclear threshold. Kristol has written that we have an engraved invitation to speak to the Iranian regime in the language it understands, military force, adding, "We can stop talking. We can hit the regime's nuclear weapons program and set it back." Michael Makovsky of the Bipartisan Policy Center has continued to release alarmist reports each year of Iran's nuclear progress, writing in 2012, "The United States needs to make it clear Iran faces a choice. It can either abandon its nuclear program or have that program destroyed militarily by the United States or Israel." Now, as you might expect, advocates of war have recycled the same arguments they made previously about Saddam Hussein. Iran is routinely portrayed as actively trying to get nuclear weapons, even though U.S. intelligence services believe it has no active weapons program today. Hawks consistently describe Iran's leaders as unstable or irrational, which is precisely how they used to talk about Saddam Hussein. They warn that a nuclear-armed Iran would be able to blackmail its neighbors, dominate the Persian Gulf, and would probably give nuclear weapons to terrorists. Failure to stop Iran would allegedly damage American credibility, trigger an arms race in the Middle East, cause America's other Middle East allies to abandon us. And of course, just as they argued that an attack on Iraq would be easy and would pay for itself, advocates of preventive war also downplay the costs and risks and argue that it would lead Iranians to rise up and overthrow the clerical regime. So much for the neocons. What about the mainstream groups in the lobby? Organizations like AIPAC have generally refrained from overt calls for war, but they've worked overtime to reinforce a hawkish line. AIPAC played a key role drafting the current Sanctions Act, the Comprehensive Iran Sanctions Divestment and Accountability Act, which broadened U.S. sanctions against Iran. That bill was endorsed by the Conference of Presidents, the Anti-Defamation League, and, I might add, by the progressive lobby group J Street. It was opposed by leading business groups in the United States and by Americans for Peace Now, a sort of dovish wing of the Israel lobby. That bill, by the way, passed the House by a vote of 408-8 and the Senate by a vote of 99-0. AIPAC also drafted a congressional resolution declaring it a vital national interest of the United States to prevent the government of Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapons capability and affirming that Congress, quote, opposes any policy that would rely on containment as an option in response to the Iranian nuclear threat. Finally, an AIPAC policy brief in 2012 warned the United States must quicken the pace and scope of sanctions while bolstering the credibility of its option to use force. Quote, the United States cannot rely on any policy that seeks to contain a nuclear Iran. So as in 2002, the key individuals and organizations in the lobby are in the forefront of those pushing for a hardline approach to Iran, and in some cases, openly favoring the use of force. Equally important, it's hard to find any other powerful constituency in the United States that favors a similar course of action. There's considerable opposition to using force throughout the U.S. government. The American military is decidedly skeptical. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates warning, if you think war in Iraq was hard, an attack on Iran would, in my opinion, be a catastrophe. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey, told CNN host Fareed Zakaria in February, quote, an attack on Iran would not be prudent. Neither the State Department nor the CIA favor military action. The Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, reaffirmed the CIA's earlier judgment that it has a high level of confidence Iran has not made a decision as of this point to restart its nuclear weapons program. So AIPAC President David Victor was largely correct when he told members of the organization in 2009, we are the only constituency in America making the anti-Iranian case. Or as the New York Times reported earlier this year, among those advocating a more aggressive approach toward Iran are groups like the Emergency Committee for Israel and AIPAC, along with the so-called neocons from the George W. Bush administration and pro-Israel evangelicals like Gary Bauer. One might add every prominent GOP presidential candidate except Ron Paul, including, of course, Mitt Romney. Romney, by the way, has called Iran our greatest national security threat. It's replaced Russia. And one of his main foreign policy aides, Dan Senor, told reporters last week, quote, if Israel has to take action on its own, the governor would respect that decision. In foreign policy terms, this is called giving someone a green light. Finally, you should not overlook Christian Zionists like John Hagee, who declared way back in 2006 that, quote, the United States must join Israel in a preemptive military strike against Iran in order to fulfill God's plan for Israel and the West. In short, it is not hard to find some very worrisome parallels between the campaign for war against Iraq before 2003 and the campaign for war with Iran today. But now let me tell you about the differences. One obvious difference is that no one is seriously proposing invading or conquering Iran. Instead, the debate has been whether to conduct airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities. The problem with that approach, though, is it can only delay the program, not eliminate it once and for all, because it can't eliminate the knowledge of how to reconstitute and rebuild the program. A second difference is that groups in the pro-Israel community, groups in the lobby, are more divided on this issue than they were over the invasion of Iraq. Unlike 2002, there are prominent voices in the lobby that reject the use of force today and call for diplomacy instead. Both J Street and Americans for Peace Now have opposed a number of AIPAC-sponsored resolutions, including the resolution rejecting containment, and other groups, such as Jewish Voice for Peace, are outspoken in opposing any military action. Third, Israel's national security establishment is far from unified on this issue. Netanyahu has continued to hype the threat, but many prominent members of Israel's defense and intelligence establishment have questioned both whether Iran is an existential threat and whether an Israeli strike would be a good idea or not. The former head of the Mossad, Meir Dogan, called an Israeli airstrike the stupidest thing he'd ever heard of. The current chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, Benny Gantz, told Haaretz, "I think the Iranian leadership is composed of very rational people," adding that he did not think Supreme Leader Khamenei wanted to get nuclear weapons. The former head of Israel's security service, Shin Bet, Yuval Diskin, warned that Israeli airstrikes could result in a dramatic acceleration of Iran's nuclear program. Last but by no means least, the Obama administration seems to recognize that war with Iran is neither necessary nor wise. And this position stands in sharp contrast to the Bush administration, which drank the neoconservative Kool-Aid after 9/11 and then conducted a very sophisticated campaign to convince the American people to support an unprovoked war. I think pressure from the lobby and the realities of election year politics are forcing President Obama to walk a very fine line on this issue, but I think he clearly recognizes that war would be foolish. Now, why is this a good thing? Well, I think both Obama and Netanyahu's critics in Israel are right on this issue, and we should be grateful that the constellation of political forces is lining up a little bit differently. So before I wrap up, let me just briefly explain why I think a war with Iran would be a blunder of enormous proportions. For starters, Iran is not an existential threat to anyone. Its defense spending is about $10 billion a year, about 2% of what the United States currently spends. It has no meaningful power projection capabilities. It also has no powerful allies, and the few allies that it does have, like Bashar Assad in Syria, aren't doing especially well these days. Second, although it would be better if Iran did not develop nuclear weapons, achieving the capacity to make a few bombs won't transform the region or turn Iran into some kind of regional superpower. Several of Iran's neighbors already have sizable nuclear arsenals. Iran could not use its weapons without facing devastating retaliation, and it couldn't blackmail anyone for the same reasons that the Soviet Union couldn't blackmail anyone when it had thousands of nuclear weapons and sophisticated long-range missiles. Finally, Iran's not going to give weapons that they've struggled for decades to acquire to some terrorist organization because, of course, they would be giving up all control over how they got used. Contrary to what alarmists in the lobby might tell you, there's no evidence that Iran's leaders don't understand those basic realities. Third, Iran has not yet decided to build a weapon, and there are good reasons why it might prefer not to. But if the Israel or the United States attacks, that is bound to convince Iran's leaders they have no choice but to acquire a real deterrent in the form of their own nuclear capability. Ironically, attacking Iran, or for that matter, continually threatening them with regime change, may be the best way to push them across the nuclear threshold. Fourth, our experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan teach us that war is unpredictable and messy. The costs can be enormous and victory can be elusive. A war would almost certainly drive up oil prices. It would threaten a global economic recovery that is still on life support. Iran will surely seek to retaliate in various ways. Groups like Hezbollah might join in by firing rockets at Israel itself. And even a totally successful strike could not stop Iran from digging out and redoubling its efforts. Fifth, an Israeli or American attack would rally Iranian nationalism, give the clerical regime a new lease on life. The current government is not especially popular. Many younger Iranians would like closer and more open ties with the West. But if the United States or Israel attacks, any possibility of an Iranian-American detente will be set back for years. And finally, this whole debate about Iran is an enormous distraction from other key regional issues, which may be precisely what Netanyahu and AIPAC want. Obama's early effort to encourage a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians have been stymied ever since 2009. Many responsible observers now believe that a two-state solution is effectively impossible, or will be very soon. That situation, in my view, is the real threat to Israel, as well as a continual problem for the United States and a disaster for Palestinians as well. For if two states are not achieved, the only alternatives are a one-state democracy, which means the end of Zionism, ethnic cleansing to remove all Palestinians from Greater Israel, or some form of permanent apartheid. Those last two alternatives, by the way, are obviously contrary to basic American values. All three options would consign these two peoples to another generation of bitter strife. And just as a footnote, we shouldn't forget this is not just a matter of realpolitik or national strategy. It's also a matter of genuine human suffering. As Palestinians face the denial of basic political rights, the steady encroachment of settlers, repeated home demolitions and expulsions, the imprisonment of thousands of family members, the daily degradation of checkpoints that stifle commerce and keep families apart, inadequate access to water, attacks by settler gangs that have increased by over 200% in the past 2 years, and countless other humiliations, large and small. Not to mention actual killings, including nearly 5,000 in the Second Intifada, nearly 1,400 in Operation Cast Lead against Gaza, and 258 dead since then. Israelis have died tragic deaths as well, but in far smaller numbers. None of this is in America's strategic interest, especially given the winds of change that are now blowing throughout the Arab world. No matter how the Arab Spring turns out, and I don't think any of us know yet, I believe future Arab governments are likely to be much more responsive to popular sentiment than autocrats like Hosni Mubarak were. Because the Palestinian issue continues to resonate strongly in Arab populations, the continued denial of Palestinian rights will force the United States to pay an increasingly high price for the special relationship, especially if the hope of two states for two peoples is eventually replaced by permanent apartheid. Which is not to say you can ignore Iran either, but it should be obvious what the proper course of action is. Having gotten back to the bargaining table, we should take the threat of regime change off the table, accept that Iran is entitled to enrich uranium in accordance with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, provided that it agrees to full inspections under the IAEA and implements the so-called additional protocol of the NPT. Washington and the other members of the P5 should also explain to Tehran what I think they already get, but we can remind them, that it's probably better off not developing an actual weapons program because some of its other neighbors might follow suit and because possessing an actual nuclear arsenal makes you more likely to be suspected if some terrorist ever got a hold of a bomb and actually used it. Washington should also be willing to begin more wide-ranging discussions on broader security issues like Afghanistan, where American and Iranian interests may actually overlap. Given the legacy of suspicion on both sides, this is not going to be easy. But this makes a lot more sense than another war or another 30 years of confrontation. And given that the United States and its allies are much stronger and much more secure than Iran is, we can pursue a policy of accommodation without worrying that our security is going to be jeopardized. If that approach fails, Iran at some point down the road decides to build and test a weapon. We then fall back on a policy of containment which worked very well against the far more powerful Soviet Union. Now, most groups in the lobby won't like this, and we should expect them to continue to beat the drums for war on occasion. Remember, the neocons began lobbying for war in the 1990s. Their efforts finally succeeded in 2003. Efforts to drum up a war have failed this time around, but it would be naive to assume that they won't keep trying. When dealing with AIPAC or the neoconservatives, the price of peace is eternal vigilance. Thank you very much.
That's terrific, Steve. I can imagine that it may have generated a few questions.
Unlikely.
So let me see. This is an interesting question. How have the neocons, take Crystal in particular, for example, managed to avoid being disgraced by what happened in Iraq? Why aren't they just a laughingstock now? I mean, who bothers to listen to them?
Well, clearly politicians continue to listen to them. I actually think this points to a somewhat broader problem in the foreign policy community, and that is that there's, I wouldn't say a complete lack of accountability, but not much. Right? I am very sympathetic to the tenor of the question. You would think that the people who were the architects of something that was as much of a disaster and as much of a foreseeable disaster as the Iraq War would have paid a hefty political price for it. No one would be paying much attention to their counsel today. But here's the problem, that a whole lot of other people were also in favor of the war as well. They may not have dreamed it up, but they backed it. So the only, as I said, I think last night, the only member, prominent member of the Obama administration's foreign policy team who didn't support the war in Iraq in 2003 was President Obama himself. Hillary Clinton, then in the Senate, voted in favor of the resolution authorizing the use of force. Joe Biden, then in the Senate, voted in favor of the resolution and spoke in favor of it as well. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates was in favor. Former Deputy Secretary of State Jim Steinberg was in favor of the war. So it's much harder for, say, Democrats or people who now see the war as having been a huge blunder to point the finger at the real architects because they were complicit in it as well. And I think this tells you something about, you know, the United States as well, that being really, really wrong about a major foreign policy thing doesn't necessarily set your career back very much. Which is not a good thing.
Okay, here's a question that may take a lot of a long answer. Please talk about the impact of the civil war in Syria. What impact is that likely to have on the relationship between, you know, the Iran-Israel-U.S. triangle?
That's almost impossible to know for sure because it's very difficult to forecast exactly what's going to happen in Syria now. It's clearly going to be more difficult to make progress on, say, Israeli-Palestinian issues as long as there's instability in Syria. And that's in part because if I were an Israeli leader, I would be concerned by what's happening with the Arab Spring, just because it's creating a much more uncertain environment. You just don't know what you're going to be dealing with in various places. There was no love lost between the Israelis and the Assad regime, either the elder Assad or Bashar, the son, but they had a, you know, they'd worked things out. They had a stable relationship. They had something of an understanding. They were pretty predictable. And in particular, the Israelis knew that the Syrians understood that they couldn't get into a direct military confrontation. If you're an Israeli, you would worry that a prolonged civil conflict in Syria could start to leak over in various ways, whether into Lebanon, possibly even into Israel itself, that you might get various forms of cross-border violence. You might have refugees fleeing across the Golan Heights trying to get into Syria or get into Israel as well. So all of this, it seems to me, is going to put what I think are, again, the sort of bigger long-term issues between Israel and the Palestinians even further onto the back burner, and that's not a good thing. The problem is we also simply don't know how things are going to evolve in Syria itself, whether it'll turn into sort of Lebanon in the 1980s or whether it will provide the sort of safe haven people talk about for groups like al-Qaeda, which clearly seems to be trying to operate there. As central authority declines, they may come in. So, you know, it's not good news for them. It's not good news, I think, for us. I believe that for some in the United States, there is a sort of a sense that this is a positive development regardless of how it turns out, because there has been this loose alliance between Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah in Lebanon. And if you topple the Assad regime, the idea is maybe you'll get a government that isn't very sympathetic to Iran, is no longer supportive of Hezbollah, and that will weaken Iran's position, its ability to meddle in various ways in that part of the world. That may work out, and that might work out ultimately to our benefit, but there's an awful lot of uncertainty there, and things could easily get much worse as well. Sorry, it's not a really great answer, but I think it's, you know, as you know, prediction is very hard, especially about the future.
Okay. Well, here's another opportunity to predict. How political do you think the whole issue of Iran is right now in the run-up to November? In other words, if Obama wins, do you think he can defuse this somewhat? On the other hand, if Romney is elected, what do you think his policy towards Iran will be?
Well, neither Obama or Romney is going to sort of immediately embrace Iran in some kind of, you know, open accommodation. I think that it's hard for me to believe that Governor Romney, if elected, would pursue a policy that would acknowledge Iran's right to enrich nuclear material. So I think we're going to continue to see a confrontation with Iran. Whether he would ultimately use military force is impossible to know. Yes, a number of his advisors seem very hawkish on this issue, but one of the things that would happen to him as soon as he was president is he would be sitting down with military leaders, and as I said, the American military is not in favor of using force, and they would be starting to explain to him all of the potential negative consequences of doing this, and he would be facing, I think, a number of fairly sober calculations. I don't know if President Obama, post an election, when he no longer had to worry about winning what is likely to be a very tight election, would then proceed to try and negotiate some kind of accommodation which essentially caps Iran's nuclear program, acknowledges that they have the right to enrich, gets them to agree not to enrich beyond sort of 5% purity, which puts as long a timeline as we can physically get between Iran's nuclear capability and an actual weapon, and then maybe tries to work out some of the other differences between us. If, in fact, events elsewhere in the region have moved against Iran, that might make it somewhat easier. One important point to understand here is that there's no physical way to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon if Iran really wants to and is willing to keep trying it. They have the knowledge. They know how to enrich uranium. Bomb designs are not that difficult. The technology is well understood. Right? So there are really only two ways to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. You invade the country and occupy it and run it. Nobody wants to do that. Right? Or you just keep bombing their facilities endlessly. Nobody really wants to do that. And then the third way, of course, is persuade them that they don't need to cross the nuclear threshold, that they would be better off staying on this side. I believe that's true, by the way, and I think it's possible to persuade Iran never to cross that line by choice. But it means stopping, you know, not pointing a gun at them constantly and saying we want to overthrow their government.
Okay, how about some additional information on the pro-Israel groups, members of the lobby, that do not support the present hardline Israeli government?
Well, the two most prominent groups are J Street, so-called pro-peace, pro-two-state solution group, and also Americans for Peace Now, who have both in various ways departed from the AIPAC line. Americans for Peace Now a little bit more distinctly than J Street has done. So as I mentioned, J Street endorsed some of the sanctions on Iran. Americans for Peace Now did not support them, and then both J Street and Americans for Peace Now oppose the so-called, you know, no containment resolution in Congress. And I think that indicates recognition among primarily American Jews, but also some others, that the line that AIPAC has pushed on a whole series of issues, including Israeli-Palestinian peace, but also support for American military action in various parts of the Middle East, has not only been bad for the United States, but also been very harmful to Israel as well. And so groups that were not willing to sort of stand up and say that 10 or 15 years ago are now increasingly aware of this problem and are willing to organize politically, try and provide political cover and some resources for political candidates, and they've had some success. So I'm in favor of what they're doing, although I tend not to endorse them publicly because that probably wouldn't help their efforts, which is unfortunate as well. One final thing, at least with respect to Israeli-Palestinian issues, my great fear, and it's sort of with a sense of tragedy, is that these groups got organized too late. That where we really needed J Street was back in the 1990s when the Oslo peace process was underway, and we really had a window for, I think, trying to put that conflict to an end. And I worry now that they've sort of finally gotten mobilized, but too much time has passed, too many facts have been created on the ground, as it were. And so, in a sense, it may be too late to reverse course there. I hope I'm wrong on that one.
Okay, well, this is a follow-up to that. Can you see any scenario in our lifetime that can lead to a genuine two-state solution?
I think it's going to be increasingly difficult. There are roughly 500,000, maybe a little bit more, Israelis now living outside the 1967 borders. And most of them are, or the majority of them are in relatively close to the border, so you could accommodate a lot of them by redrawing the border slightly. But there's 150,000 or so that are well inside the West Bank, and removing them is not going to be easy at all. One can imagine ways of resolving it. The problem there is that first you've got divisions within the Palestinian community, divisions between Hamas and Fatah, but I think even more important, given that it's the Israelis who hold the high cards, is that the Israeli political world has been drifting steadily to the right over the last 20 years or so. The settlement project has been supported by all Israeli political parties in one form or another, but there used to be a fairly sizable political left in Israel sort of peace movement there, and that's almost completely gone. And for a variety of different reasons, Israeli politics has become more conservative. So if part of this involves Israelis recognizing where this is headed, I just don't think that's likely to happen. And I don't think the United States is in a position to put pressure for largely domestic political reasons, right? If Barack Obama, who I think clearly understands this problem very well and tried to do something in 2009, is not willing to push it, it's hard for me to see when an American president is likely to. Now, having said all of those depressing things, people do change their minds. People sometimes see the light and recognize where a train is headed and decide they want to shift it onto a different track. So I don't rule out the possibility that you'll get, sort of an awakening on the part of enough Americans, enough Israelis, enough Palestinians that you could get some kind of reasonable deal. But I haven't seen anything in the last 4 or 5 years to suggest that that changing of consciousness is really happening.
Okay, we've got time for one last question. And this, again, Steve, we're going to be asking you to look into the future. What do you think will happen in terms of the possibility of an attack against Iran? Do you think that, a lot of people speculate that the Israelis may do something prior to November because it would be very hard for either Obama or Romney to react negatively to it? Do you think that's a likely scenario, or do you think after November the whole thing will sort of evaporate?
I'll go out on a limb here and say that I don't think there will be either an American or an Israeli attack between now and November. The reason I don't think there's certainly not going to be an American attack, like we're not going to start anything, because the last thing any incumbent president would want to do is start a war with all those unpredictable consequences in the immediate run-up to an election. Secondly, I don't think the Israelis are going to do it because, in my view, the Israelis do not have a strategically meaningful military option. I mentioned that Iran has built this enrichment facility essentially under a mountain in Fordo. It's under 30 meters of solid rock, or maybe it's 100 meters. We have some bombs that are probably big enough, some earth-penetrating ordnance that could get down and in several repeated strikes damage or destroy the facility. The Israelis do not have any airplanes that are capable of carrying those weapons. So even if we gave them the bombs, we'd have to also give them the planes, different planes, ones they don't fly, which we're not going to do either. So I think the Israelis can attack Iran. They can damage the enrichment facility at Natanz, the reprocessing. They can do a lot of damage to Iran's nuclear program, but they can't eliminate it, which means it's not a strategically meaningful strike. You're entertaining, outrage from the rest of the world, all sorts of unpredictable consequences, the possibility of Iranians conducting more attacks on Israeli citizens around the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you're not changing the basic problem, which is that Iran has an enrichment capability. So I don't think the Israelis are going to do it, and I think that most of this has been largely a bluff designed to keep the United States giving them more things and focusing all of our attention on Iran, and maybe down the road convincing us to do something ourselves, but I don't think they're going to launch it. After November, then my suspicion is you'll actually see a renewed attempt to try and make some kind of diplomatic deal work out, and I hope that's what happens. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.